Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm very happy to share with you my ministry, and this is where I'm working at Lutheran Altenheim Society. And this is also a little brochure that you may find interesting on the profile of the elderly in America. I guess my real interest in the elderly developed even before I got into ministry, when I, many years ago, had a great interest in my own family history. And at one point in our family, there were five generations with my son and me and my grandfather and my great-grandmother and my great-great-grandmother, my son's great-great-grandmother. There were five generations, and I found that listening to their histories and talking to them and their stories was exciting. And I had a grandfather who was a minister who encouraged me to go into the ministry, and listening to him and his stories was just exciting. When I got into my first parish, I had a country parish with a lot of elderly. In the little community that I was in, there was only three or four little churches, a large Catholic church and the Lutheran church, and then two smaller, a Methodist and a Baptist. And so that there were only four or five ministers throughout the county who could do anything working with elderly. But when I went to the nursing homes to visit my members, I found out that really nothing was being done in the nursing homes for the elderly. And so I started some Sunday and afternoon worship services and got volunteers involved. And then later on, got involved in Project Compassion. And if you haven't gotten a leader's guide, before you leave St. Louis, why don't you pick one up from Synod? Because it gives a lot of helpful information on projects and developing leadership in your congregation with working with elderly, because every congregation has them. For the first time in the history of our country, the elderly, those over 65, is greater than the teenage population. And this is the first time in the history of our country that that has happened. Every day, 5,500 people turn 65. And so this is going to be a great, I think it's going to be a great talent for us to tap in the future in terms of getting people involved in ministry. And I think there's a lot of ministry that they can be doing. Working with elderly in terms of getting them involved in community projects through the church. Tutors would be a program. One lady decided that she was concerned about children coming home to an empty house, so she set up a program where children could call her on the telephone. And in the space of the time that she had set this program up, she had something like 200,000 calls. And she did this for just a few years, but she did it as a public service, but she did it because she was concerned about people. And she did it because she had the time. And there's a great deal of untapped resources amongst the elderly that we have to use in the future, and I think our church is going to need to rely on them. Because as you get into ministry, you find out, take a ladies' aid organization. The ladies' aid organizations are made up of the elderly in the congregation because the young families work. Almost every home now needs a working mother if they're going to make ends meet. And that's just one of the realities of the society we live in. And almost every family needs two working people in the family in order to meet their budget goals. And so the people who are running the societies, the ladies' aides and the men's club, are older people. I'm the youngest man in our men's club at church. Since I've taken this position, I've joined a congregation and I've become active in that congregation in some of the organizations. So I go to men's club for one reason, so I can play pinochle. But it gives me a break every Tuesday evening a month to play a little pinochle. But, you know, I'm not even 50 yet, but I'm the youngest person in that men's club. So that we have to more and more in the future rely on our senior citizens, our elderly, our retired, to be doing some of the programs. And we have the most educated and probably one of the richest retirees, or the retirement population is well-educated and also wealthy. When we say that the poor are not wealthy, that's not true. The people who are retiring, and then some of the people are retiring younger, are retiring because they have good retirement programs and they have quite a bit of money set aside, or they own the house they live in, and therefore they have quite a bit of wealth that they can rely on so that they can retire. And these are the kind of people we're going to have to put more and more emphasis on in terms of ministry in the future. It was as I went to the nursing homes and began to develop programs for the residents that I had found a great love for the elderly. I was a history major and I always enjoyed history, and I love the history of the elderly. They have a great story to tell, most of them. For example, had a little gentleman within the last year that passed away, and when he died, the undertaker said, "Should we have a military funeral?" I noticed that he was a veteran, and the family said, "He was a veteran, but we won't have a military funeral. He was a member of the German army, and he had won the Iron Cross." But in talking with him, Adolf Hitler was his platoon leader in World War I, and he always said Hitler was a great guy. He said Hitler, you know, he didn't believe all the stories about Hitler. He said Hitler was a great guy. So I remember once when I was hungry and Hitler shared his lunch with me. In fact, the family was so anti-Hitler through because of their father's stories about Hitler that they changed their name. But the history, you know, the story, the history lesson that you get out of that kind of a conversation is exciting. Or another gentleman who was in World War I, and he was in the submarine corps. I didn't even know they had submarines in World War I, you know, but when he described them, they were exactly what you would imagine them to be. They were little tin can boxes that took on ballast and sunk and, you know, and came back up occasionally. They did not have self-contained batteries. They had to go back. They could only go out into the ocean for so many hours. Then they had to come back and run acid back into the tanks so that the batteries would work. And he told me once that in the process of doing this, it was like when one of these old railroad engines that would pull into the station and the water would come down and fill up the boiler, and off it would go again after it got its tank filled with water. That's the way they had to fill these tanks up with acid in order to keep the batteries going. And he told how one day he was in charge of that, and as they put the hose down, the acid came down all over his body, and all of his clothes were burned off, but he luckily had no injuries. Fascinating stories. And being, as I said, a history major and enjoying history, this kind of a sense of history was exciting. There was somewhere in Luther's writings, he said we should change professions every 10 years. And I think I've just about done that. I was a school teacher for 11 years. I've been in the parish ministry for a little over 14 years, and now I'm in chaplaincy ministry. And as in the chaplaincy, I really see my job in terms of two two lines, I guess. Really, I'm a chaplain to the institution. And as a chaplain to the institution, I had some notes here and I'm not sure where they went. But as chaplain to the institution, I am responsible to the administration, and they pay my salary. And therefore, I represent the Altenheim Society at meetings like this, where I try to give the story of the Altenheim Society. The Altenheim Society here in St. Louis was founded 80 years ago with the idea of helping indigent elderly to have a place to stay. And when it was first organized, someone could give $300 and that would be a life contract for them to live the rest of their life. In 1929, the life contract went up to $1,000 a year. For a $1,000 donation to the Altenheim Society, they would be permitted then to live in the facility until they died. We think of that in comparison to the cost today, where the average cost today is about $1,800 a month. You can see that an elderly person needing nursing care would come to us and say, the first question we ask is, well, you know, how much, what resources do you have? Well, I've got $10,000 in the bank, I've got a house. What's the value of your house? Oh, $60,000. So that means that someone has a value, assessed valuation of about $70,000. That's going to last maybe 4 years. And last year I buried one lady who was at the Altenheim 27 years. She moved in there when she was 78, and I buried her when she was 95. There was a lot of money that was put out by the Lutherans in the community to keep her in the nursing home and to keep her in a Christian facility. But as the chaplain to the institution, I certainly do public relations, but I also represent the people to the administration. Twice a week we have a meeting called OPCs, Overall Plan of Care. Once a quarter, we evaluate every person in our facility. And they're evaluated from nursing standpoint, social service standpoint, and spiritual standpoint. We evaluate them in order to see once if they are properly placed. We have a nursing facility, and we also have a residential care facility. Just this morning, one of our gentlemen who was in nursing was moved from nursing to residential care. He has progressed to a point where we feel he can go back living independently. Of course, financially it's a little cheaper for him, but it also is great for his self-worth to know that he is going to go back to a facility or go back to a room where he will be self-care, where he will be independent, where he can no longer have to have a tray brought to him in his room, but where he can walk to the dining hall. It does a lot for his self-concepts. But anyway, I'm part of that team where twice a week we sit down and evaluate these people to see once whether we're meeting their needs. There are some times when we say, Mrs. Schmidt is not doing well, she should have heavier care, and therefore we may have to move her to a higher level of care. I'm part of that because we see the spiritual dimension in that move as also being very traumatic and very important. The chaplain becomes a very important part of that movement. As the chaplain to the facility, I also see myself having a responsibility to the staff. We have 280 residents, and we have a staff of around 320. And so I also become then a pastor to some of the staff people. I have had staff people from the nursing department who have come to my office and who have consulted with me. One nurse recently came to me concerned about a daughter who is 21 who's dating a gentleman who's 40. And she's very concerned about that. And the problem bothering her affects her work as a good nurse. And so I have made myself available and opened myself up to the staff that I can help counsel them or be there for counseling or whatever they need from me. And then in that same line, when one of the staff people becomes ill, I try and visit them in the hospital, or I'll send them a card, or I'll stay in touch. One staff person recently had a death in the family. Again, this kind of trauma shows up in that nurse having maybe a bad day at work, and that translates in some poor care for our residents. And so I try to be there and give her some help in terms of working through her problem. She had the death of a grandmother. And so as chaplain, I work in terms of public relations. I work with the staff. I work as we do the overall plan of cares for the residents. But then I'm also the pastor of the congregation. We are unique in that we have a congregation in our facility. We have a chapel. You're going to visit many nursing homes where there is no chapel. You may be asked as a pastor, would you come to the nursing home on Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock and lead a devotion? And so you get there and you find out that they've set a little table up in the middle of the lounge with maybe a little white sheet over it to serve as an altar, and there may be a Bible laying on it. We are unique in that we have a chapel, because we feel that the chapel and the message of the gospel is centered to the whole facility. And I spoke to the nurses this past week, because we've been having some problem with some new nurses' aides who do not understand the philosophy of our home, that we are a Christian home. And so I've been concerned about some of the language that I've been hearing from nurses and nurses' aides. Some profanity, and some of these old Christian ladies say, I've never heard anything like that in my life. So I try and help counsel some of the staff people in terms of what the philosophy of our home is, and how this kind of language is not always acceptable among some of our people. But being pastor of the congregation means then that I do all the work that you do in a congregation. We have our Sunday morning services. We have a regular service. We use the old TLH, and I think we'll probably use it for the next 20 years, because until this generation that's using it now gets to the nursing home, they won't be ready for it. So we use the old hymn book, and we use a regular order of service. One lady recently said, Pastor, I'm so anxious to get to the nursing home because I haven't been able to get to church for 5 years. She's in a wheelchair, and her family just was unable to get her out of her house, down her steps, and to church. But now that she's in the nursing home, she comes to church regularly. And it's exciting to have someone like that participate, because you can just watch as the service builds and her enthusiasm, and it's just exciting. On Thursdays, we don't have any. Now, the one nice thing about this ministry is that there's no evening meetings. See, I put my congregation to bed at 7:30. You see, in a parish, you can't do that. But, you know, that's one of the advantages. Some of the disadvantages are I don't have any baptisms and I have no weddings. Have a lot of funerals. Last year we had 86 deaths, and I had 43 funerals. Some of the people, not all the people, transfer to our congregation. A lot of them continue their membership in their home congregations and let their pastors. But sometimes they, because they've been a member at St. Paul's Church for 55 years, they don't want to transfer away from that congregation. But then when they die, the family says, you know, Pastor Hilmer, you've been their pastor now for 2 years, and they don't know the pastor that's over at their congregation. You just go ahead and conduct the service. And so that works out that way too. But on Thursday mornings, we do all of our stuff on Thursday mornings. That's our Wednesday night services on Thursday morning. And we kid about that, because we had a good laugh to think that Ash Wednesday service is Thursday morning. And some of those ladies always get a big kick out of that. You know, Thursday morning, well, is this Ash Wednesday service? Yep, Thursday morning, it's Ash Wednesday service. So, but that's been sort of the tradition, that on Thursday morning we have, during Advent and Lent, we have our Lenten services and Advent services, and the rest of the time we have Bible class. And we get about, we have 280 residents in the home, we get about 60 or 70 down for Bible class, which is a pretty good number. Because on Thursday morning, some of the ladies are going to get permanents and hair fixed, and the doctor is in to do some examination, and some of them, yesterday we were having Bible class, and the foot doctor was there, and he had quite a few people that he had to examine, so our attendance at Bible class is limited somewhat by what's happening in the rest of the facility. But there are some people who, I had a joke with one of the nurses last week when one of the ladies had the Bible classes at 9:45, and she had a 9 o'clock hearing appointment with the doctor to test her hearing aid, and she was down there about 9:05, and she says, you have to be done with me by 9 o'clock, otherwise I'm not going to stay. And the nurse says, you have to stay, this is important. And the lady says, going to church is more important. And the nurse said, this is more important than going to church. And I heard her. And I said, and I stuck my head in the door and I said, Lydia, you go ahead and tell Lynn that church is more important than your hearing test. And the nurse turned real red. And she said, well, I didn't quite mean it that way. But we have a lot of fun. But Thursday morning is Bible class. On Tuesday and Friday evenings, we have evening devotions on all the floors. And we go around to all the dining rooms and have an evening devotion. The first Sunday of the month is communion. And communion is, as Harold knows, Harold has been working out at the nursing home for the last few months. Appreciated his help. But the first Sunday of the month is communion. We only have it the first Sunday of the month because it's an entire day of bringing the sacrament. And for the first time in my ministry, I think I'm really understanding what sacramental ministry is. To see these people who for years and years have been coming to communion and to be able now at this age and in whatever state they are in to have the sacrament is a very meaningful, especially some of these people who are in bed and close to death. One of the ladies that I've been ministering to died last night, and when I think about, you know, her, my ministry to her over the last few weeks as she was dying, it's just a really beautiful relationship developed between us, and the sacrament for her and all the other people becomes very meaningful and very important. And sacrament on that first Sunday of the month is very important, and it takes a lot of time. We commune about 130 in our main service, and then we commune in five little services on the floor, and then we go around to give private communion, so that by the time I'm done on a Sunday, I will have communed about 210 people. And it takes a full day. And I could divide it up, but I don't know, just something about that first Sunday being communion, and people look forward to it then. It's sort of hard to say, okay, we'll do the private communions Monday morning or something. It's just, they hear the sermon as they listen in bed, the services broadcast throughout the house, and there's something about that day that they're quite interested in. And you get a new perspective, too, on pastoral theology. You know, we talk about communion in terms of the right words and the right technique and the right mode and method of giving communion. And some of these old people who have been going to communion for 80 years, you don't tell them how to take communion. They just do it the way they want to. I remember one lady, she said, when is communion? And I have to yell in her ear, next Sunday. And I'd go into her room and I'd set up communion, and before I even had a chance to start speaking the words, she would say, give it here, and she would take it. And that was it. You know, she said, I want communion, and I want it now, and I don't want all this waiting around, you know, for you to, you know, she couldn't hear much of the words anyway. But, you know, I didn't try to argue with her about what was the proper mode of giving communion. She wanted it, it was there, she took it, and she had the body and blood of her Lord in that manner. We would say, boy, that's not the way we learned it in pastoral theology, but you know, it's when you're dealing with people, what you learn in the course isn't always the same as how it affects people. And as I said, I work quite a bit with the families of the residents. We're going to hear more and more as the population of our country gets older and older. We're going to hear more and more about Alzheimer's disease and the dementias, which are Alzheimer's disease is probably one of the most dreaded disease of the elderly, because it truly is a disease where a person is a living dead. The person's mind is dead and they're still a person. And in my ministry, I have begun a group for families of the Alzheimer people where they can talk about how they feel and where some of the people who are still keeping their relatives at home can talk about their feelings in terms of what's going on in their their lives. Once every 2 months, I also am involved with a families of residents meeting, because it's traumatic. It's traumatic for the person who becomes a resident of a nursing home, but it becomes traumatic for the family to think that they have had to put mother or dad in a nursing home after all these years. And so bi-monthly we have a meeting of family members who can come and voice their gripes or complaints or share their feelings. And I and another minister on the staff, he's not involved with the residents, he's in charge of outreach ministry. But he and I run that group because out of all the people on the staff, we are probably the least non-threatening. And so we feel people can open up to us. And if there is a problem with nursing, we can bring that problem back to the nursing staff. But we are not judgmental. Having a nurse with us that evening could cause some problems if someone would have a gripe or a complaint about nursing, and this way we just listen and then we take the problem back. And usually once the person has voiced the gripe and we listen and comment on it, usually the gripe goes away because all they want is the ability to voice it. What have I left out in terms of my job? I had a nice set of notes here somewhere and I don't know what I did with them. But that gives you a rough idea of my job. As I said earlier, I see my job in two directions. One is chaplain of the home and the other as the pastor of the congregation. Are people still bring their offering to church? If I have 150 people in church on Sunday, I'll have probably $150 in the offering envelope or in the offering plate. Just recently, I've been there at the Altenheim 2.5 years, and 1/3 of our offering on Sunday morning goes into the Helping Hand Fund. And so just recently, I decided I'd ask what the Helping Hand Fund was. You know, I figured, you know, about time that I figure out what these funds are for. The Helping Hand Fund goes into a special fund for people who don't have any money to have money for offerings on Sunday morning. So that means that 1/3 of my offerings on Sunday morning is recycled every week. But with the rest of the money that comes in, we buy large print devotional books, we pay for the organist. When someone dies, we give a $10 memorial gift to the building fund. Large print devotional material, we give out about 100, and let's see, I give out 135 large print portals of prayer and about 50 small print portals of prayer. And those are provided by the congregation's ministry. We have 280 people totally. That includes some people who live in our cottages. Out of the 280, 208 are in our nursing facility, and out of the 208, 90 of them are Medicaid. That means their funds have run out, and the money has to come from other sources. And that's where we rely heavily on the congregations in the area to support the ministry. The government only pays 80% of the cost of someone in the home who's on Medicaid. So that means the other 20% we have to, as a home, pick up. That is our charitable allowance. In 1980, our charitable allowance was something like $27,000. Maybe that was 1982. Last year, in 1986, it was $400,000. That's how much the charges, that's how much the prices have gone up in 5 years. Especially energy costs, food costs, and costs for staffing. Okay, we've outgrown our chapel. We have about an average of 140 in chapel. Our facility is better than 80% Lutheran. We cannot discriminate on the basis of religion, but however, the state does not fault us for making Lutherans, giving them the first priority, since it is a Lutheran home, and and supported by the Lutheran churches in the community. But at the same time, we have to make the facility so there is a somewhat of a waiting list, especially for some nursing facilities. But if a non-Lutheran comes along and puts their name on our waiting list and their name comes up, then we'll give them preference. Usually the people who are non-Lutherans are on the list because they have Lutheran family. Recently I had a funeral for a lady who was Catholic, and we kidded about me having a good Lutheran mass in our chapel, but she was Catholic, very active in her church until she came to the nursing home and came to church in our chapel and enjoyed the singing and enjoyed the services and told her family that when she died I would have the funeral for her, which I did. But she was there simply because she had a large Lutheran family that was supporting her. Just a few other figures. About 70 of our residents, that means one-fourth of our residents, are over the age of 90. Two of our residents are over the age of 100. The lady who is 103 had a birthday a week ago. She's been in our nursing home now 2 years. When she came in 2 years ago, she was upset because her doctor wouldn't let her finish painting her front porch. And the thing we always kid about is that she came in at the age of 101, and her kid brother was already in the nursing home 5 years. He's 89. So a lot of interesting things that go going on. We get about 140 people in our chapel. 60 to 70 of them, about half, are in wheelchairs. Mission work. There's great opportunity for mission work. Had a lady, grew up Lutheran, but had fallen away from the church. And she admitted that when I talked to her recently, she said it was a very simple reason why we fell away from the church. Once the children grew up, once they were no longer involved in the school, we just no longer were active in the church. I said, well, you're still Lutheran as far as I'm concerned, and you hear the services over the loudspeaker, and would like to invite you again to come back to communion and become active again in our Altenheim congregation. And that was about 4 months later. One Sunday she came to church and wanted communion, and so that was an opportunity for us to regain a lost sheep. One lady was active in the Christian Science organization because through the last years she has been having a lot of difficulty, and hoped that through Christian Science she would find some help for her problems. Once she came to the nursing home, I encouraged her to come to church, and finally confirmed her and made her a member of the Altenheim congregation. Again, how do you confirm someone who's 90 years old? You can't take them through a 16-week confirmation class because they could die after 5 or 6 lessons, you know. So I try and begin them at a point where I talk with them and find out where they are in terms of their own knowledge and understanding of God and faith and Christ and religion. Usually they can say, oh yes, when I was a child I went to the Christian church, I went to the Methodist church, and I remember this and I remember that. And from that then I'll begin trying to talk with them in terms of what our Lutheran doctrine is and what our Lutheran faith is, and try and work through at least a proper understanding of the Lord's Supper and the gospel message. And then if I feel they can articulate that and confess that, then I confirm them. Not in any, we don't have any formal confirmation class, but it's interesting that most people, when they get to be 85, will remember their upbringing in terms of, one lady said, or no, it was a gentleman, he just went to the hospital and has not been interested in religion at all. In fact, I've talked with him, but he got sick a week ago, and now he's been in the hospital a few days. But just before he went to the hospital, I went up to see him and I said, Joseph, I want to have a prayer with you. I want to talk to you about your faith and And in the process of talking with him, I found out that he grew up in the Christian church in Indiana many years ago, and he talked quite a bit about his, you know, his upbringing as a in the Christian church years ago. And so a lot of these things come back to them as they get nearer and nearer to going and being with the Lord. And it's those kind of things that I try and plug into in terms of confirming them, helping them to acknowledge and confess Christ as their Lord and Savior. Okay, maybe there's questions. I've probably talked too much. That's the preacher syndrome. Yeah.
Do you have any inklings of what to do, or have you been able to do anything yet? Obviously, I haven't been there a real long time, but what to do with the people who have Alzheimer's, and how you can still minister to people in that condition? Have you found anything that seems to be helpful?
Oh, yeah. I think just, I find out that a lot of these people plug into what they've been used to. You know, it's not unusual for someone who's got Alzheimer's to be able to say the Lord's Prayer or to remember some hymns. I remember one old gentleman is, if you get him started on a German hymn, he'd sing five or six verses that, you know, he just would keep going because, you know, that some of that. The problem with Alzheimer's, strangely, is that they can remember the past, but they can't remember the present. So that I remember one lady who always would talk about her husband, Ralph, but when Ralph would walk into the room, she wouldn't recognize him. But she knew she had a husband, Ralph, and she'd talk about him, and he was such a wonderful guy, but she didn't recognize him. And I could get Dorothy started on a hymn, and she'd sing two or three verses with me. Same way, she'd recite the Lord's Prayer. She'd confess the Creed. In fact, one of the problems was the nurses sometimes would get angry with me because I'd get her started on a hymn, and she'd sing that hymn all day, you know, loud as she could in the dining room, and, you know, and the nurses said, don't get her started, you know. But, I mean, to me it was important that she be in touch with these things. Yeah. But I think, you know, we don't know what, you know, we don't know that much about what the mind is doing. The same way with someone who seemingly is comatose. You know, what do we do when we walk into a hospital room or into a nursing home and the person is laying there like a vegetable? How do we minister to that person? And I say, minister to that person the same way as if the person were awake. Pray with them. Sing hymns with them. Read to them. Because we don't know what's going into the psychic. We don't know what the brain is going to be recording. I had a lady who was supposedly comatose in the hospital. And I went in to visit her, and the nurse was working with her, and I said, excuse me, I'd like to visit this lady. And the nurse said, oh, it's no use, she's in a coma. I said, that's okay, I'm gonna have a prayer with her. And the nurse kept working, and then so I think I sang a hymn and had a Lord's Prayer, and all of a sudden the nurse said, what's that noise? I said, she's singing with me. And she was actually singing the hymn. What a friend we have in Jesus. That's the theme song of the Altenheim. I think the first day that I was there, I sang it 12 times. And from after that, I decided I'll choose the hymns from now on. Because you get tired of, yeah, it's a beautiful hymn, but you get tired of the same hymn time after time. So, any other comments or questions?
You said there was another pastor that works with you. He does mission work.
He just does outreach ministry. He works with congregations, helping the congregations to work with programs in their congregation for elderly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there are
two pastors on staff, but he does nothing in terms of working with the residents. In fact, he don't even know most of the residents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I've never called upon him even to preach because he said he'd rather stay out of that field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have any ministry to the residents done by laymen of area congregations or by teenagers?
Mm-hmm.
Or by, you know, or is it all clergy done?
Oh, no. We encourage the lay people to come in. I have two churches that send their youth groups on Sunday to help push wheelchairs. I have one church who's working on recruiting some volunteers to come in and be readers. That's one of the needs that we have, is volunteers who can come in and read for residents. We have about six people who are blind and yet very astute who just need somebody to read to them. And, you know, and we just don't have enough volunteers to do that. I encourage the ministers, even if they transfer their people to my congregation, to come by once in a while and pay a visit and continue, you know, their relationship with the people as much as possible. One of the things that bothers me is that even if a person is not transferred to my congregation, I'm bothered by the fact that a lot of pastors do not get in to see their people very often. And that's a concern to me. In some cases, you know, they probably are thinking, well, there's a full-time chaplain there and they'll do the ministry. And I'm glad to do it, but I still think that there's a point at which the minister has to keep in touch with his parishioner. You just stop by and say hello, if nothing else.
I think of the benefit for the young people themselves in touching, allowing themselves to be touched, seeing death and the threat of it very real. What a orientation or reorientation or evaluation it gives them as they, you know, all of a sudden comes the personal application, hey, I'm not going to live forever. As this is very real. I guess the other question I was going to ask is, do you have any dogs?
Oh, yeah.
On TV the other night, there was this gal working in a retirement home or a nursing home or whatever, and she was hearing impaired, and she had a dog who did the hearing for her, but all the residents just love that dog. They kissed the dog, I think,
yeah,
as much as the dog, you know, came up and kissed them or whatever. And it was really amazing. It was just a beautiful story on TV the other day.
When I took this position, I had a part German Shepherd, and my wife decided that since we moved away from the parsonage where my dog had a lot of friends and moved to a house uptown, that our dog needed a playmate. So she found another dog. It was a female. But anyway, these two dogs, we never seemed to be able to separate them in time. So over the course of the last year and a half, these two dogs have made 25 puppies. But what happens when these puppies are about 4 or 5 weeks old, I take them to the residence. And they play with them and just have more fun with them. But then the staff people see how cute the puppies are, so they take one home. So I've gotten rid of all my puppies that way. That was terrible way to get rid of them. But the people love the dogs. Just love dogs. And then another lady brought in her cats, and that's just really something. I remember one lady who was in bedridden, and we put that little dog in bed with her, and she just cuddled up to that. We couldn't hardly get it loose from her. Yeah, but that's true. Children. I've been getting some children to come during their Sunday school hour and be part of our worship service and sing some of their children hymns. And boy, our people love that. They just love to have children come by and keep in touch. Just their eyes just glow when there's children, or when our organist comes and brings her baby and the baby cries during church and everybody looks around, you know. They say, doesn't it sound good to hear a baby cry in our church? Because that's not something we hear too often. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to phrase it, but I wonder if you had any ideas or methods that you use in dealing with people who become really frustrated because their eyesight is gone and their hearing is gone, and you speak to them and they only hear half of what you say, if that much, and you can't show them because they can't see it. How do you deal with that in ministering to people?
Well, I guess it's just a matter of trying to be patient. You can do a lot with people like that with touch. I think of one lady, she still has a little bit of hearing in the one ear, and I can but you know, even that I notice is getting worse and worse. But to give her a cross and have her touch it and feel it, something that has some value like that is very important for them to be able to touch it. So I guess that's one of the ways I deal with it. You just have to deal with it with a lot of patience. Use a lot of simple words and, you know, simple comments. And try and remember too, when you're dealing with these kind of people, just, you know, to speak up, to be, you know, to make sure that you speak a little louder. Don't do like the one lady, you know, who was blind, and I always kept talking to her loudly, and she said, "I'm blind, not deaf." And you know, you forget that sometimes.